Yes, if you'd go ahead and mute your audio, that would be good. And we'll get started. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jamie Ard, who is a professor of epidemiology and prevention at the Wake Forest School of Medicine. He's also a distinguished expert in the field of obesity medicine, and I've had the privilege of getting to know him through the National Academies of Sciences and a professional society called the Obesity Society, and to hear him talk on this subject last fall, as I mentioned, I think he's got some fantastic content to offer us, and I just must say that I am so grateful that you would take your time on this Sunday morning to talk to a group of people that are really eager to hear the perspective you have to offer. And I am very grateful. I'd like to start, though, with just a brief prayer. God, we thank you for this good day that you have given us, for this opportunity to be together and to learn and discern your purpose for us in the words that Dr. Ard will share with us. Help to open our minds and our hearts and see a better way forward. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Over to you, Dr. Ard.
Well, let me start by saying thank you. I really appreciate the welcome and the invitation to be able to present to you this morning. Especially as a part of this series that you all have put together. I had a chance to look at the presentations by Minister Lowe and Dr. Cody Stanford, and those were really wonderful and informative, and I hope that I can continue in those traditions to stimulate some interesting conversation and hopefully some introspection, some discussion. But I will admit that, you know, part of the reason that I agreed to Ted's invitation, aside from him being a wonderful person and a great colleague, was because he convinced me that you all were really interested in doing something different based on the information you learned. So I don't want this to be something that you walk away and say, that was a really entertaining presentation. That would be nice, but that would not be the compliment to pay. I think the compliment that I would want to hear is I decided to do something as a result of hearing this information. And if I can do that, if I can help you think about that, then my job is done. And I am hopeful that this is going to be an exercise in, you know, leading to action. So let me get started, because I want to provide enough time, ample time, for us to be able to have some dialogue. Because I really want to hear from you, and I want to be able to understand your perspective on this topic. So let me get myself organized here. I got lots of windows open. I believe you should be seeing my slides now. So let me start by giving a little bit of additional context here, because this topic, this talk has sort of evolved over time. And originally I was asked to do a talk in this area on disparities in the context of trying to advocate for expanding Medicaid in the state of North Carolina. We have not done that. And this was back in the fall, in the early fall, and we were, you know, in the midst of the pandemic and really seeing, you know, great disparities as lots of other places have seen. And one of the challenges is that we've not increased our coverage safety net. And this has, you know, become a political issue because policymakers have to make that decision. But I was asked to basically lend my voice to that conversation on the perspective of health disparities. And then I was also asked almost in the same time frame to plan to do a talk on health disparities for the Obesity Society, which is where Cal heard me have this discussion. And I think all of these things start to come together, partly as a result of just the challenges of 2020 and the revelations that I think the broader population started to really see in a way that could not be ignored, with social injustice and the differences in outcomes as a result of the pandemic. And so I think that over time, my thoughts about this have evolved, but I think the central question and the data and the history that I want to present to you, that hasn't changed despite the audience. And I think that this type of information is, these are the type of data and history that we don't really talk about and think about our current context. And that's what I hope to be able to do. So, you know, when I was asked to talk about health disparities, it struck me that even though everyone is focused on this, the disparities that are highlighted by the pandemic, you know, these disparities have been around for a long time. And a lot of my research focuses on addressing many of these disparities that I've come to really just sort of accept as a fact of life. But the question that has stuck with me is, why does the most advanced country in the world have such poor health outcomes for some segments of its population? Where did this come from and how did we get here? So let's start with this quote by James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. From the birth of this nation to present day, Blacks and other disadvantaged groups have endured health outcomes that are generally worse than those of advantaged whites. History shows that the disparities in health outcomes we observe are not by happenstance, but results of intentional decisions designed to limit access to healthcare. There are several examples throughout history that illustrate this point, starting from slavery to the current pandemic of COVID-19. In the next couple of slides, I've just pulled together some statistics that highlight some of the disparities that I think about or deal with on a regular basis. These are just a few of the examples that we could talk about all day. I know Dr. Cody Stanford reviewed some of these in detail in her presentation. I won't dwell on them except to say that they do exist for people of color and those in lower socioeconomic groups. So here you see information on type 2 diabetes prevalence by race, ethnicity, and you will see that African-Americans and other people of color have much higher proportions of individuals with type 2 diabetes as compared to non-white, non-Hispanic whites. This is from my own county in Forsyth County, where Winston-Salem is located, and you can see preventable death from cardiovascular disease and stroke is nearly 30 points higher compared to other race ethnic groups for Blacks. And then obesity, which Dr. Cody Stanford went into in detail last week, significant disparities by race, ethnicity. So the search for answers to my question on why does the most advanced country in the world have such poor health outcomes for some segments of its population and how do we get here took me back to the beginning of Black's existence in this country. Understanding how healthcare was approach for slaves is quite informative for framing our current context. And I show this picture as maybe some homework for those who might be interested in delving into this history. If you don't know the story of Dr. J. Marion Sims, who is the father, quote unquote, of modern day gynecology and his experimentation with Black bodies, you should take a look at that. This is a portrait that shows one of the women that he conducted at least 30 procedures on without the use of anesthesia when anesthesia was indeed available. But part of his reasoning for doing that was that he felt that Blacks did not have or had a higher pain threshold than whites and experienced pain differently. And so they did not need such type of care. So the slave owner's perspective was to keep his investment safe while providing the bare minimum required to do so. Typical rations provided by slave owners are shown here. The rations were supplemented by what could be grown or caught in a small plot of land. Conditions on plantations fostered the spread of infectious disease and parasites, and nutritional status increased susceptibility to those diseases. All of these were compounded by prejudices of physicians. What do I mean by that? Well, as the status of American physicians increased, they became central figures in providing the quote unquote evidence of the inferiority of Blacks through pseudoscience. However, they ignored a lot of the basic tenets of science that they professed to promote, you know, ignoring cause and effect of poor conditions and undernutrition. So for example, if we think about pica or dirt eating, clay eating, we know that this is a symptom of iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia. These physicians coined a phrase that was peculiar to Blacks called cachexia africana and ignored the fact that the diet of Blacks was deficient in iron and simply said that this was something that was inherent to being African. And so then you have a resulting series of treatments that are very misdirected and very cruel that, you know, don't address the underlying conditions. So as we move forward to Reconstruction, Congress creates the Freedmen's Bureau following the Civil War, designed to address areas of need for free Blacks and poor whites in the South. Healthcare eventually became part of that mission. Blacks suffered from disease outbreaks in encampments that included smallpox, yellow fever, and cholera. And even though legislators knew the benefits of sanitation and quarantining, freed slaves were not assisted in managing these outbreaks, and mortality was extraordinarily high. And what I'll say here is I want you to start thinking about the parallels that you see from the 1800s to the 20s to now, and start to think about what are those things that seem like repeat sound bites or repeat phrases that could have been easily uttered by someone in the year 2020. The rationale for willfully ignoring these problems was twofold: keep the infections from spreading into white communities, and providing assistance to freed slaves would only breed dependence. Ultimately, the ruling class felt that a healthy Negro population would upend the social order. Therefore, disease was weaponized to limit the ability of the freed slaves to pursue the basic tenets of what America promised for everyone else: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As perverse as this sounds, this became internalized and reframed as Blacks being inferior and inevitably fated to poor outcomes. The prevailing theory was that the Black race was genetically predisposed to poverty and unhelpful living conditions, leading to high morbidity and mortality, completely ignoring the social circumstances that existed to create those very conditions. Practically, this meant that things like life insurance were not accessible to Blacks, with many actuaries believing that the Black race would go extinct by the late 1900s. So imagine if you are trying to pass on any type of wealth to your dependents and heirs, and you can't even get a life insurance policy that helps the next group of individuals, the next generation, to be able to live a better life than you lived, or to at least help them make up for the difference in loss of income that you would have provided. I think this is a really telling quote from the author Wolf in this article. It could be said that the life insurance industry came full circle for African Americans who were the first to be insured for the wrong reasons and the last to be insured for the right ones. As we move forward in history, we see the South rise during the post-Reconstruction era to cement a segregated society as a way of life. The Southern states consolidated influence by voting as a bloc to help limit federal oversight and maintain states' rights. Segregation had a direct influence on Blacks' ability to access healthcare systems and achieve healthfulness. One example of how this power directly affected disparities was the Hill-Burton Act, passed in 1946. This act provided construction grants and loans to communities that could demonstrate viability based on their population and per capita income in the building of healthcare facilities. By the turn of the century, nearly 6,800 facilities in 4,000 communities had in some part been financed by the law. My guess is all of us have been involved in healthcare delivered by one of these types of facilities funded by this law. As a bipartisan law, it codified the idea of separate but equal in hospitals and healthcare facilities. Southern segregationists were needed to pass the legislation, so they exacted the compromise that each locality could maintain segregated facilities if desired. John Kinney, who is the president of the National Medical Association, which is the oldest and largest organization of Black physicians, explained in 1963, racial discrimination in medical services and facilities was understood to be, quote, one of the prime reasons why Negro infant mortality is 2 to 5 times greater than white infant mortality, why white women are 5 times less likely to die in childbirth than Negro women, and why Negro life expectancy is almost 7 years less than white life expectancy, end quote. So this relates to a bit of local history. For me, a group of dentists and physicians in Greensboro, which is down the road, sued Moses Cone Hospital to gain access to that facility for their patients. And ultimately, they prevailed in 1963. Their victory outlawed the idea of racially segregated healthcare. Although I will point out that it took a while for Cone Health to actually apologize for this policy. As you may see, this article is published in 2016. If we go back to another point in time in the post-Reconstruction era, we can see another major development in healthcare that also contributes to health disparities. Before World War II, as medical care and hospital-based care became more accepted, hospitals and physicians needed a better way to get paid consistently by more than just the wealthy. So before World War II, healthcare was a cash-based experience. During World War II, labor shortages caused intense competition for workers. A wage freeze was enacted to avoid inflation in wages. So companies worked around this by offering health insurance as a benefit to attract employees. The IRS made those health benefits exempt from taxation. This made health insurance most affordable when acquired through a job. So if you didn't have insurance through your employer, or you weren't a wealthy individual who could afford to pay for your health care, then you didn't have access to health care. So insurance through employment becomes the norm, but companies discriminate and decrease the opportunities for Blacks to be employed, and Blacks often work in positions, even when they do get jobs, without health insurance as a benefit. Therefore, Blacks were largely kept out of health insurance market through no fault of their own. Even when Blacks could get employed in positions that offer benefits like health insurance, they only had limited access to health care as a result of that discrimination. Today, I would argue that a lot of the same forces are at play, and most uninsured are working individuals who do not have the fortune of working at a company that can provide insurance as a benefit. So now we move forward to 2019, 2020. And we have different ways of thinking about race and factors that influence health outcomes. We know that important factors like access to healthcare have a direct impact on health outcomes. Even though we understand this, we are having a very difficult time moving away from what has been a very entrenched way of thinking about health. Individuals just need to take more personal responsibility, if you will. If assistance is provided, it will breed dependence, for example. Even though the odds may be stacked against you, if you just work hard enough, you'll get access, the so-called pull yourself up by your bootstraps argument. We know that these things, as you've seen in just a very brief, you know, few moments of presentation, are being recycled from the past. These are not new concepts that someone thought up as a novel way to communicate how we keep certain resources for certain groups of people. They are directly out of the playbook from the 19th century. I'll just very briefly highlight some of the COVID statistics because I believe that these data, again, just highlight where we are now, and with some of that historical context, provide a very clear, or at least a different perspective on why we got to where we are now. This is recently showing that nationwide, Black people are dying at about 1.6 times the rate of whites as a result of COVID infections. Here are data from North Carolina, again, showing a higher percentage of death relative to the percentage of the population and the percentage of people who are experiencing infection. COVID has shown a bright spotlight on a sore spot that we have not taken seriously. This pandemic has highlighted the life and death consequences of our inability to protect the most vulnerable in our society. So I come back to our opening quote by James Baldwin. We are now face to face with this history and its tentacles that continue to reach into our present day, keeping us mired down in the same way of doing things, but hoping for a different outcome. What will we do? While the times have changed and there are no overt efforts to create separate healthcare facilities or exclude non-whites, right? We don't see whites-only signs. Many of our decisions about who should have access to healthcare resemble the actions of the past. It should come as no surprise that the least advantaged among us suffer the most poor health and are most vulnerable during a crisis like COVID. So when we think about history, we've had multiple opportunities to change how we respond in the course of our nation. And we've consistently chosen to deny healthcare to those that are most vulnerable. It's time to give voice to this injustice and call it what it is. Here's one example. Again, if I use the Medicaid expansion status by state, you can see some very familiar themes in terms of the legacy of slavery and the vestiges of Jim Crow and ongoing issues related to segregation. We recently celebrated the MLK holiday, and one of his famous quotes is, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane." So again, as I started off, I said part of the reason I agreed to participate in this conversation was because Taya convinced me that this was a group that was ready to move to action. And as Minister Lowe talked about, you know, to be complacent is to be complicit. This is a systemic issue and requires dismantling. It goes beyond simply acknowledgement or understanding. This won't just sort of unwork itself. It's woven into the fabric of how our country operates. And in order for us to move into a different direction, I think we're going to have to actively engage rather than passively acknowledge. So I am not a, you know, specialist in disparities or racial injustice or any of those things, but what I feel like I can do is at least facilitate a conversation from my point of view and give you a perspective. And so I challenge you to do something in response to this information. The legacy of MLK is that we carry that on through his remembrance, and we do that through action. And so I think there are three, you know, areas that we could talk about. Acknowledgement, right? So just educating yourself and understanding, as I said, that a lot of the buzzwords and new phrases that, you know, become sound bites in posts for social media to make it palatable for today's audience are, you know, directly out of the playbook of segregationists and white supremacists and slave owners from decades past. And then sharing a counter narrative. So when you are in that space where you hear those myths and those falsehoods being perpetrated and perpetuated, being able to step up and share counter narrative and help explain why those vestiges, even those are hundreds of years old, still have implications for what we see today. I think advocacy is another area where we can all engage. If your state hasn't expanded Medicaid, what can you do to get involved? There are lots of organizations on the ground that are working on this, and you can be a part of that that voice that helps to change that type of policy. What can you do to ensure that the safety net is adequate? Because without those safety nets in place, we know that people, the chance of mobility in terms of the socioeconomic ladder goes way, way down. And we've got to move away from this, you know, mentality of it's all about self-determination. When in fact, this country is built on free labor and forced labor by an enslaved group, you know, and that a group of people benefited from that. Then I think activism is another part of that. Engaging in figuring out how to address structural racism. No one person is going to fix this, but collectively we can. And I have to have that hope for my kids and my grandkids and, you know, people that are coming behind us, that we can leave this place better than we found it. And then I think, you know, having the courage to be an active bystander. And this is where I think, you know, those small conversations and hearing people out, but also being able to challenge people and let them know that there's right and right and there's wrong and wrong. And when people are perpetuating things that are not true, that are not based in fact, or that are really born out of a white supremacist perspective, then I think it's important to be able to call that out. And we have to all do that together. It can't be just the Black people in the room who talk about Black Lives Matter, right? I think that has to be all of us together in order to be effective. So I am going to stop there. And I am interested in hearing people's feedback and perspectives. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ard. And this is powerful information. And I think your question to us of, you know, so how do we act on it is really important. I do want to ask you about something that's woven into what you're talking about and woven into what we've seen in the recent past. And that is the human capacity to rationalize many things, whether we're talking about some of the things from long ago history, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, drapetomania, but it astounds me. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the capacity to rationalize and strategies for overcoming that rationalizations that we all encounter just about every day.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there are a couple of interesting things related to that, Ted. So one is it's human nature, right, to do this. And this is why these things show up over and over in our history. We have a tendency to want to make ourselves feel better and to feel like we're good people and to reconcile that discomfort that comes from something that is either challenging or concerning. And I think that's one part of it, you know, in terms of, you know, this rationalization that we all have, and we do it in lots of different ways in lots of different domains of our life every day. The other part of this that I think is operative is the fact that when we repeat certain things over and over and over again, that starts to become the truth. That starts to become reality. And I think when you look back through history and you start to see how a lot of these atrocities become perpetuated and no one steps up and says anything. You think about our current history and the political environment, you start to see, well, one of the mantras is that, you know, people just repeat the same thing over and over again. Even if it's a lie, if you keep hearing it, you start to believe, well, that must be the truth, because you don't hear any other counter narrative. And so when you put those things together, where everything that you hear tells you that you are better than this group of people, and you wrap in religion and say, well, it's our divine right. And then you start to bring in science and you know, have people that confer with you and bring in, you know, a justification. It starts to all make sense, right? And you can create this narrative that makes you feel totally justified, even divinely so, in doing the things that you're doing. So I think it's a very complex human behavior, but it is our innate built-in behavior that we have to guard against. Because otherwise, as we've seen, in multiple different societies and communities, these things can always happen.
Thank you. I see in the chat box, we're starting to get some questions, and I also welcome people to unmute their microphones if they want to pose questions. Will is asking, as a medical educator, what do you see being done to train new physicians to reduce this unconscious and conscious bias that has been practiced so widely?
So this is an area where I think we need to do more, but there are efforts, you know, afoot to try to systematically educate our newest physicians and healthcare providers on, you know, these social determinants of health, the natural biases that we bring to the table based on our, you know, limited experience in life. Everybody has biases, and they're a result of the context that you know, live within and experience. And a lot of medicine is about pattern recognition, right? So when you start to, you know, you are taught to put things together to come to a conclusion or a series of judgments. And that allows you to, you know, begin to, you know, make a diagnosis or figure out which diagnostic testing you need to do. But we, I think there's more and more being built into the curriculum to really talk about those things, but it's a long slog because it's not just about the education. A lot of it is about having more people of color in the educational process, right? So if and this is something that we're dealing with locally within our own health system, is racial equity and justice in the entire health system, and it includes medical education. If I walk through the halls of my medical center as a student or a faculty member, and the only people that I see in portraits of leadership are individuals who are white men, then I start to have this perception that I don't belong, right? And then if the only people I see in my instruction are individuals who are white, and they have a very similar shared perspective, then I often don't get any alternative perspectives or you know, any other sort of filters of the information and the and I just don't see people that look like me in those roles. And so I'm not sure that I have the wherewithal to be there, right? I have to see one to be one. And so those are some of the things I think we are trying to address and thinking through. And that's a multifactorial sort of process of, you know, addressing the pipeline from preschool education all the way through medical education. It's a process of mentoring. It's a process of understanding all of those things that impact achievement and retention. So it's a really complex situation, but we are, I know lots of places are working on it consistently to try to get, you know, to some of those root causes and to really help increase the consciousness around prejudice and bias.
There's a question here from Tony Norman, who's going to be our speaker next week. And I have to say, I'm really looking forward to this too. But Tony asks, is there a consensus in the medical community that these disparities are real and should be addressed by the medical community and the federal government? Are doctors and medical researchers conscious of this? And is it a topic that is breaking through the indifference in current laissez-faire narrative?
Yeah, so I think that in general, medical professionals do agree that the data are very clear on these disparities and that they are real. I think we are, the point that we are moving into now is really trying to understand race as a social construct, not as a biologic construct, right? And really trying to untangle, well, if race isn't a biologic construct, why do we see this segregation of outcomes in this particular group who self-identify as Black, right? And that's where we start to delve into all of these other social determinants of health that, again, systematically, as a result of policies through federal and local governments and so forth and so on, lead to a lot of the, you know, differences in the opportunity to achieve healthfulness. And so I do believe that, yes, this is a serious part of the conversation in terms of national healthcare. I believe that the Biden administration is taking this seriously in terms of how they're thinking about approaching health and informing policy by engaging people of color as a part of that administration in critical roles to really help inform how we go about, you know, trying to deal with these issues.
So another question that's come in here is from Steve's iPhone. So I'll make the presumption it's from Steve. It says, we've learned about the discrimination built into the original Social Security Act, which excluded farm workers. When Medicare was enacted, was there a similar sort of discrimination built in?
So that's a great question. I don't know that I know specifically if there was a particular type of exclusion for Medicare that was built in terms of when that policy was passed. I will say I do know that the reason we got to Medicare was because Truman actually wanted universal health coverage and came up against forces, including the American Medical Association and others, who basically linked universal coverage with communism. And that basically scuttled the effort to get universal health coverage. And eventually that, you know, got morphed into and moved to Medicare, where we said, okay, at least we can cover individuals who have retired and protect them. But even when Medicare was being pushed, people had the same argument in terms of this is communist, this is not, you know, the American way, quote unquote. And, you know, again, those types of arguments are born out of a protected class wanting to maintain protected status.
So another good question from Tony, before I pose it, I want to warn Bobby and others who are active in the Peace and Justice Commission that I want to give you guys a chance to talk about how do we meet the challenge of rather than being silent and complicit to turn our awareness into action. So that's for you, Bobby and Dan, and anybody else on the team that wants to talk about it. But Tony asks, how do you maintain your hope in the midst of the arrogance of medical colleagues who don't see it as clearly as you? Is there a generational bias toward a more liberating counter-narrative?
Well, I think that part of my hope is that there's still capacity for change in everyone. And I think that while I believe that it takes all of us, that doesn't mean that we can't get things done if we only have a majority, right? So, you know, some people may not change, and that's okay. But we can make a difference. And I think those that are coming behind us are being exposed to a very different type of world and narrative. And, you know, despite the last 4 years and the prominence of the white supremacy movements and the visibility and the microphone that they were able to have, I do believe that, you know, over the course of time, we are moving towards progress. And there are more people in the medical field who understand, maybe not fully in have the same shared experience, but there are more people who do, you know, want to take care of people, and they understand, you know, human life is valuable in all ways, and that, you know, some people have a better chance at that than others based on the social context.
So a question from Carol Galbraith, who wants to know your thoughts about teasing apart race and wealth. She says, I think we also have a wealth supremacy mindset. He is so rich, he must be worth more. I think health charts might look similar for rich versus poor, yet even if we could fix the wealth problem, I don't think it would address the race problem. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. And I agree, even if we could close wealth gaps, we probably would still need to have different work to do on racial issues. And the reason I say that, because there are data that suggests very clearly, you take two professionals, same income, same education, one Black, one white, you see still differences in health outcomes in terms of blood pressure, risk for cardiovascular disease, mortality, et cetera. So a Black person achieving the same income and education is not as protective as a white person achieving that similar level of income and education. Now, you point out a very specific word in terms of wealth, right? So wealth is a really big gap, right? it's not just income inequality. Wealth inequality goes back to some of the things that I talked about, like life insurance policies, right? If my great-great-grandfather couldn't get a life insurance policy, and his kids couldn't get life insurance policies, and then when my parents could get a life insurance policy, they didn't have the resources to pay for it. They just got us through college and then said, you're off on your own. Then by the time I make it to, you know, my status now, the amount of wealth that I have accumulated relative to my colleagues is very different. It's very, very different. And one of the ways that I see that play out from a individual clinical standpoint is what I call sort of the, you know, what's your reserve resource, right? So when you think about, when you come up on a hard time or a difficult situation, how much resource do you have to call upon, you know, in reserve to be able to marshal and move and create a positive outcome or change the trajectory of the outcome? For a lot of African Americans, they don't have that reserve resource. And that could be wealth, that could be income, that could be cash available on hand, insurance coverage, you name it. So our wealth really is in our social networks, in our family, in our church homes, et cetera. But when it comes to actually having like, oh, my parents can, you know, pull equity out of their home to send my kids to college. And so that means I can save for, you know, X, Y, and Z. I don't have that. I don't have access to that. Whereas a lot of my colleagues do. And so those are things that, again, are going to take a lot of time and effort to address. One, but we got to, you know, again, continually call it out and acknowledge it. And then we got to talk about, well, how do we change that? What are the structural changes that need to happen so that, you know, those things don't continue to widen, right? If we just think about higher education, the cost of college education, or any sort of secondary education is going up. And even now public education for primary education is, you know, starting to be part of that difference, right? It shouldn't be that way. And so those are the things that I think are going to continue to make that challenging to start to untangle this issue around wealth and race, right? That's why I think a lot of it, you know, continues to go together.
So I want to, we're quick running up on the end of our time, and I want to mention one thing that came from one of our presenters, which one of our people who asked, Kathy asks, would you be willing to share your PowerPoint? We can post a PDF of it if that's possible with the recording of the talk, just as we
sure did. That'd be fine. Yeah,
that would be great. And then Kathy Painter says, and this is where I want to ask folks on the Peace and Justice Commission, the church is in a unique position to show compassion, empathy, kindness, and developing an accurate position of ourselves and others. How can we collectively as Christian people take an active role in addressing disparities?
Okay,
happy for you to answer that, and I'd love to hear from anybody else who's listening on that subject. I see Bobby is unmuted, so.
I am. I was trying to send a chat, but we're working on a different computer and I couldn't get it to work. So I'm just gonna use my voice here. What I wanted to ask, which is really going to maybe address in some way what Ted is asking, and is, I know we work somewhat with hunger, and we work with an organization that is an advocacy organization that sort of does the homework for people who are trying to figure out how to influence laws to benefit marginalized people. And I was wondering if there is any such kind of connection that we could make with people who are working on healthcare issues to move healthcare toward more equity. The problem is, for individuals to just jump into this and try to find out about it is a real challenge. So if there are organizations that can help us with that, it would be really good for us to know. There has been, I would say, considerable support in Westminster for advocating against hunger. So I would imagine that would translate to working on this issue. So if you could give us some hints where to go with this, that would be great.
Sure. So, you know, one of the great things about saying, hey, I want to get engaged in health disparities work is that you can do almost anything and you can say that it's going to be connected to health disparities. So for example, working on hunger, we know that people who have food insecurity have a higher risk of developing obesity. And we know that obesity leads to lots of other chronic diseases. And so you have a higher risk of diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease in people who have persistent exposure to food insecurity. So the work that you're doing in addressing hunger actually can be part of your mission on related to health disparities. So I think one of the things I would encourage you to think about in the work that you're doing and you know, understanding where you go in terms of a direction is, you know, saying we're working on health disparities can be a really, really big, big topic, right? Because I come at it from a perspective of obesity, because that's what I do. But there are disparities in nearly every health outcome that we think about, from, you know, maternal fetal outcomes to cancer and everything in between. So I think you can think about, okay, if we've got an organization, we've got a health message that we are actively addressing, then that can be one of our areas of focus. If you want to be, you know, sort of maybe at another level in terms of a little bit more broad, then you can think about policy work and engaging in policy work that is going to have an impact on the safety net, for example. So I think, and again, that could be very broad. That could be from, you know, advocating for, you know, pre-K access for everyone, because we know you give kids an early education opportunity, that's going to change their health trajectory over time, right? So there are lots of these links, and these are not, you know, tertiary, so, you know, three steps removed. These are often very direct links that we have good evidence that this is impactful. I will put a plug in for American Heart Association. That's an association that I've been working with over the past several years. And they've made a very specific effort to focus on their mission statement that's going to focus on health equity. And a lot of the things that they are doing in local communities is really focused on improving the chance that everybody has the opportunity to be healthy. And so if you want to look into the American Heart Association, I would encourage you to do that. They have lots of local events and they have lots of money that they are moving into communities to help, you know, work with, or, you know, organizations on the ground to do delivery of healthcare around nutrition, around blood pressure, around heart health, all of those things. And they're focused on food insecurity. They're focused on safe neighborhood spaces for walking, all of those types of things. So that's an organization I'm involved with, and I know what they are doing as a part of their mission. And I think that's another, you know, sort of direction that you could go is, you know, find an organization that you know and trust and is engaged locally that you can then connect into.
I'm going to stop the recording here and say thank you, thank you, thank you so very much for an outstanding seminar this morning. Stopping the recording doesn't mean that we have to stop talking or close off the session. I know other people have other questions, but we've really, you know, demanded a lot of your time already. So it's really up to you how long you want to hang around and just chat. But thank you so much. And I think the challenge that you've given us to think about how do we go from being complicit to taking action is an important one for us to take part and to act upon.